When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to a long overdue Powder Blue podcast. I'm Jeff Mosher. Frank Close couldn't be with us for this one, so we call in our favorite pinch hitter, none other than our man, Greg Hall. What's going on, Greg? Always good to have you back on the Powder Blue podcast.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks for having me back. I appreciate it. Listen, I was a career pinch hitter, so I'm happy to keep that going. And it's so much fun to be back. I'm really excited. Thanks for having me.
I'll tell you, I called on a different podcast that I do. We had a fill in, and my trademark line is when there's a good pinch hitter, I call him the Matt Stairs of pinch hitters, and everybody kind of gets it, you know, the reference. Well, I was feeling old on this day in a pod, and I called somebody the Kirk Gibson of pinch hitters. And like, I don't know if you can pay somebody a higher compliment than that, but you also have to sort of be of a certain age to really understand it. So the reference kind of went over the guy's head, and I'm like, just Google it, you know. You're a baseball guy. You can appreciate a good Kirk Gibson pinch hit home run in the World Series. Of, you know,
he went and reached and he went and got that one with the fist bumps and everything. That was in the dirt. Yeah. Like I was blown away. It's an iconic clip.
Yeah, literally on one leg out there.
Yeah, right. Gimping around the bases.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So look, we got a Phillies team we got to discuss here, because believe it or not, and if you go outside, you know, and feel the weather, it's hard to believe it, but opening day is next week, at least for every team not named the Padres and the Dodgers. And by the way, have you been a baseball man? Have you woken up that early to watch the Soul Series or not?
I have two kids under six. So yeah, I was up.
Oh, so you were already up.
I was already up, and I got, you know, the beautiful thing about having an iPad is just throw it on the iPad. The kids can do whatever, watch Bluey, and I can watch a 15 to 11, 6 a.m. baseball game. Nothing like it.
Yeah, nothing like watching Manny Machado moonshots at about 7:18 in the morning. I'm with you. But
yeah, in front of 15,000 people that don't stand. It was it was a wild couple of days of baseball. And there's just something so fundamentally weird about now they have to go play games that don't matter for 6 days, and then they go back out and start over again. That's just a weird thing for me to wrap my head around.
We could do a separate pod about baseball's continued struggle to market itself correctly. For example, a really cool idea doing the prospect breakout series in spring training, showcasing the prospects, but then also doing it concurrently with like the Big East tournament, the SEC tournament. Like, there's only like 1 or 2 weeks a year where the casuals are watching college basketball, and that happens to be the week or two, which I still caught some time for the prospects, but like, you couldn't just figure out some other time when March Madness is not like the number one thing going on. But you know, that's baseball. We could do a separate podcast. Bottom line, opening day next week, Phillies Braves. This Phillies team, really fascinating for us to talk about, right? Because it's a ready-made Super Bowl contender, at least, a ready-made World Series contender, at least it's supposed to be, compared to some other Phillies teams in the past and maybe other ball clubs who have podcasts. Like, there's really not like a thousand different things I think we need to laser focus in on. So let's just get to what we got to talk about here. Let's start with the starting rotation. Widely considered one of the best in baseball. We know, look, and I think what a great benefit we're seeing of Ranger Suarez getting to camp on time, getting stretched out, getting himself in shape for the season. He's had a really nice spring, very encouraging. We know what Nola and Wheeler are. They tend to start slow. Hopefully they'll start a little bit faster, but you know, what really made them a great pitching staff last year, Greg, is to be able to get an amazing first half. They got out of Taiwan Walker, and then Christopher Sanchez coming out of nowhere to emerge as one of your better fifth starters. Neither of those two having good spring. So I ask you, on the level of it's just spring training, or I'm concerned, where does Greg Hall fall?
Let me first start by saying Greg Hall falls in such a happy place that we even get to say the words, this team is a ready-made World Series contender after the previous decade. Yes. So like, let's not take that for granted. We could be Nationals fans. We could be Royals, Tigers, Athletics. Oh, man. But hey, listen, we are where we are, and I'm happy to say that. Where I fall on the scale of one to worried is it's spring training. Christopher Sanchez trying to work in a cutter, right? And that's been the bread and butter of Caleb Cotham. He's worked it into a lot of different people. Not everybody, Zach Wheeler, who can just take a splitter and say, all right, it's my best pitch now, no problem, and just dominate with it. I'm not worried about Sanchez so much because my expectations for Sanchez are not what he did in the second half last year. My expectations for Sanchez as a number five is get me 9 to 10 wins and get me a 4.5 ERA. I'm happy. Just don't walk everyone and their mother like he did early on in his career. I'm fine with that. The Phillies Achilles heel to begin last season was the fact that a Matt Strom was their five and one of their better pitchers, but they were like at one point 2-15 or something when the number five starter was pitching in the rotation. So to have a stabilizing force is fine. I'm actually more worried about Taijuan Walker. Not so much for the spring results either. I'm more worried about the fact that this guy can't get through the first inning without giving up six runs. And then you look up and he's given you six innings, but there's five hung on the board. The 15 wins was a mirage. I'm not a pitcher win guy. I don't think that's a legit stat. I'm just more worried about he had those comments right after the season ended around like, oh, you should have used me or could have used me or anything like that. They said that's behind them, but it still happened. They didn't use him in the playoffs. He's here for two more years after this one at a number just under 20 million. It's an untradeable contract unless you literally pay off the whole thing just to get him off the books. So I'm actually more worried about Walker. With that being said, it's a good problem to have. They have a top three rotation and the National League may be top five in all of baseball. So I think that at the end of the day, I am probably in that 3 to 4 range on the scale of one to worried. It's not a big worry for me.
Yeah, I'm with you. And I think that, listen, I think every Major League Baseball team would love their number one concern in pitching to be their fourth and their fifth starter. It's fair to say some teams at least have a bullpen guy who they could then put in to the rotation if their fourth and fifth start, and maybe the Phillies could use that. And, you know, Michael Lorenzen was out there for a while. He just wound up signing with somebody whose name escapes me right now.
The Rangers.
The Rangers, which seems like a good...
Only $4.5 million.
Oh, yeah. See, so that's
only $4.5 million.
Efficient signing for them, right? And you wonder if
very
maybe
much
why the Phillies wouldn't have done that. But to get back to Walker, I guess the only thing that makes me... besides the fact that we're talking about the four starter, the only thing that might make me a little encouraged is that with him, it seems to be a velocity thing right now. Yes, he can't get out of the inning. People are on it. He's only throwing like 89 to 92. He missed some time. And I believe he went through this last year and was able to get it back up. I feel like if you just, he may start off slow and maybe, Greg, maybe you make Sanchez your number four and use that off day early on in April to skip Walker, if you feel like he needs just to continue to build himself up, right? So that he gets the off day and the extra rest and you're not relying on your fifth starter in April as much. It's an idea. I know that would make you go lefty-lefty, Suarez-Sanchez. Yep. I don't know if they want to do that. But to me, that's not as important as getting my pitcher stretched out and in maximum shape that he can be.
I think it's a good idea. I think it has legs. But for me, the Phillies... one thing this season that separates them from years past is their April is kind of a cakewalk. The Braves are tactically March, but their April's not so bad. When you look at April, it's the Reds, the Nats, the Cardinals, the Pirates, the Rockies, and the White Sox all at home.
Wow.
Those three series. And then the Reds, Padres, and Angels. So it's really not that much of a gauntlet. So if you needed Taijuan to get some confidence, if you needed him to get off to a good start, those are some of the teams that he can do that against. So If he physically needs it, sure, I'm okay to make that switch. Lefty, lefty, whatever. I think that's probably a little bit, yeah, you want a different look, but at the same time, just get outs. And so for me, if it's physical, that's one thing. If it's a mental thing, if it's being strategic about your rotation, I'm letting Taiwan pitch against, you know, the Pirates and the Rockies and the White Sox and those teams who we could really capitalize, get some momentum by the time the schedule gets a little bit tougher.
Sure. Now, remember, when we talk about the Phillies in April, we have to put into perspective they are not they're not the April team that they are in June, July, and August, and not just Kyle right. Schwarber, but as a team. So when you, I sarcastically thought to myself when you read all those like teams that they're playing that aren't very good outside of the Braves, I thought, oh wow, that just sets up really well for them to be about two games above 500 when they should be about like 10 games above 500. But you know what? I'll take above 500 for the Phillies in April.
If we run into the same issue this year that we did the last two with April and early May, then we are in a rough spot because the schedule does get tougher. You get a lot of easy games to start. Yeah, to your point, this team's got to be 8 to 10 games over 500 by midway through May. They just have to be instead of 8 games behind. You just cannot play that game. If you want to challenge for the division, if you want to exceed that 90 win mark, really make a statement, cement yourself in the fourth wild card, or the fourth place, I should say the first wild card, the fourth place overall. That's what you really need to do. The Padres just got better. The Mets just got a little bit better. The Reds are knocking on the door. The Cubs brought back Bellinger. You never know with the Brewers. And the Diamondbacks got better over the offseason. And the Giants just signed Chapman and Snell. They got Soler. So there's going to be a lot of competition for the three wild card spots. Mm-hmm. Don't put yourself in a hole. Dominate these teams that you should be dominating.
100% with you. You can't always rest on your laurels. You can't just assume every year you're going to get the last seed, beat the Braves or any 100 plus win team. I mean, you're built to be a division champion. And let's be honest, the last 2 years, the Phillies have basically lost the division in the first 6 weeks of the season because they built a hole too much to climb out of. And it's great to play hero ball for the last 2.5 months of the season, but I agree with you. When you put together the roster that you have, you shouldn't have to play hero ball. They have to figure out a way to start better in the first 6 weeks. And honestly, we laser focus on Schwarber a lot because he doesn't seem to hit home runs until June, right? But Wheeler and Nola are two guys that you have to shine the spotlight on here because those guys are just historically slow starters. It would be nice if they just came out of the box with a little bit more oomph going on. Like you mentioned, Wheeler's working on the new pitch. Listen, I'm not expecting them to be like Cy Youngs for the first, but like you got to put the team on your back a little bit, I think, and give your team a chance to win the game, which Nola in particular doesn't always do.
I'm hoping Nola takes those learnings from late last year when he made the adjustment to the pitch clock where he was literally just looking in a different direction. I'm really hoping that carries over because remember the pitch clock is 2 seconds faster now. So somebody who was already struggling to adjust to the pitch clock last year in Aaron Nola, it just got even harder. So hopefully he is in that rhythm now and can make those adjustments quicker because Aaron Nola was one of the most frustrating pitchers to watch last season. I'm happy he's back. Was seven too long? Sure. But at the same time, the Braves were knocking on the door. The Padres offered more. I'm happy he's back. He is a very good number 2-3 starter at this stage of his career, probably more towards a 2A. But you know what? At the end of the day, I trust him. And I think he's going to be able to make those adjustments. And I personally think Zach Wheeler is going to either finish first or second the Cy Young this year. I truly believe that. No homer, no bias.
No. I mean, listen, he's adding a new pitch and he's picked up where he's left off. I mean, I expect him to, I agree with you. Having a nice spring, 2 ERA, 0.89 whip. So everything's looking good with him.
Real quick, the split looks nasty. It drops off the table. It reminds me of like Hector Neris's splitter and just filthy when it's on. So I'm excited to see how he fits that into his sequencing, how he fits that into his pitch mix. And if that's more of an out pitch, kind of like a chase pitch, it's just going to be fun to be able to see something different besides fastball sweeper.
I agree. It's a perfect pitch for a guy like him because he has so much life on his fast stuff. And he also has a very unique, they talk about this, like his release point is like the toward the home plate is, I think, fourth shortest distance. It's not like he's the tallest, longest guy, but he just has an excellent release point that's very consistent. So when you're trying to read that ball coming out of his fingers, right, and you're thinking fastball, same grip, it just gives you that much little less time to adjust to the fact that this thing might just die right there in the dirt and you're already flailing. So I love it. I think it's a great pitch for a guy like him, and I'm excited to see him unveil it. Bullpen. Let's hone in on a few guys here. I keep waiting for Sir Anthony to be a dominant guy. And I think at this point, I just have to live with the fact that he's going to be an erratic guy and he's not going to be an 8 or a 9 inning guy unless Hoffman and Alvarado have already been used at some point. And, you know, I'm looking at the spring. And again, I try not to make too much of spring. I know he's working on things, but the ERA is 4.5. Not terrible. Only has 6 strikeouts in 6 innings, though. That's not what I usually look for with Sir Anthony Dominguez. You know, I know when he's on is when people can't touch his stuff and his fastball has life and knows where it's going, not where it's last year in the playoffs where who knew where it was going and the Braves were getting themselves out on it.
I am of the – when I watch spring training baseball, I'm of the results don't matter, but I watch the action. So, like, I'm looking at the life on the pitch. I'm looking at location. I'm not looking – if you're testing out a new pitch, if Topper says, hey, just throw the fastball today, I'm not going to get, you know, hurt if you throw a fastball, gets hit over the fence. What I will care about is if JT or whoever sets up low and away and you miss by 4 feet. Mm-hmm. And that's what – you know what I mean? So, like, those are the things I'm really watching. And with Sir Anthony, he drives me wild more than almost any other reliever. He's the right-handed Gregory Soto. We already have one of those frustrating guys who should have the best stuff on the planet, but hasn't. He struggled to harness it, and he'll look dominant for two hitters, and then he'll give up a bloop single, and then bam, the wheels kind of fall off. So I can't get a read on Sir Anthony. I'm hoping that those first two outs are more indicative, and maybe with that third out he's tinkering with something or trying to work on a way to get some sort of weak contact or working on a new pitch that I'm unaware of or something like that. But for me, if Sir Anthony doesn't deliver by May, I'm supplanting him with my trust with Kirkering. If Kirkering gives you almost anything, I'm a believer in Orion Kirkering. He has to establish the fastball and not just live slider all day. Teams will pick up on that. But if Sir Anthony starts to struggle in that seventh inning role with him and Soto kind of splitting that duty, I'm letting Kirkering take that role. I'm eventually letting him supplant Hoffman. And eventually I would love to see Kirkering splitting with Alvarado from a saves perspective. I know Topper's he's more of a closer by committee guy, but yeah, I am keeping Sir Anthony away from the ninth to start the season and probably away from the eighth again, unless injuries or like Hoffman is all of a sudden completely ineffective. Those circumstantial things. But yeah, Sir Anthony's the one in the bullpen where I'm like, oh man, you never know what you're going
to
get.
Right. And this goes back to sort of the rotation conversation. If you can just say right now that you're feeling pretty good about in any form or fashion, whatever 3 innings they pitch, Alvarado, Kirkering, and Hoffman, then worrying about Sir Anthony Dominguez is literally worrying about the 6 inning guy, which you may not have to use 3 out of the 5 times. I mean, but it's the potential though. That really makes it frustrating, as you're saying, him and Soto, because these guys have such electric stuff and, you know, you just want it so badly for them because you know how dominant they could be. But I suppose if they were, then they'd almost be damn near perfect, right? If they had a pinpoint location, then they would be amazing by now. It would almost be unfair.
They would be the two that are in the closing spot versus Alvarado and potentially right. Kirkering or Hoffman. I mean, like both of those guys have major league saves under their belt. Soto has a 30 plus save season under his belt. Yet we're talking about both of them in that sixth inning role. That's a heck of a problem to have. But at the same time, it's because both of those dudes have been so inconsistent, have the big blow up appearance or that big blow up thing that makes you want to rip your hair out. But at the end of the day, I'm also not super worried about the Phillies bullpen. It's one of the better bullpens in the National League. It's one of the better bullpens they've ever had. I remember the 2020 bullpen when Ramon Rosso was the first guy out on opening day and got shellacked, never pitched in a major league. We traded for Heath Hembry and Brandon Workman, and they both stunk. And so, it's not that long ago that the Phillies had the literal worst bullpen in the history of the game. Again, we have a pretty good problem on our hands.
Not to harken back to bad times, but that really was a special year because they had the worst bullpen in the game and they made two trades and somehow made it even worse than it was before, which nobody could have comprehended. I remember a game against the Orioles where they literally had to use like nine pitchers. And this was before the Orioles brought all their prospects up. I mean, it's like literally like guys like Juan Mateo out there getting five or six hits. And I'm like, what is going on here? But yeah. Unfortunately, the flu has really kind of taken its toll on this team. It set back a couple of guys, and Kirkering is one of those. And I know that there was a reporter, Rob Thompson, was saying that Orion might not even be able to make it to opening day because he just hasn't had enough time, or I'm not even sure if he's thrown yet in spring training.
He's going to resume this week.
Right. So we're all sort of going off of what we saw last year, but I agree with you. I don't think what we saw was mirage, and I really hope that once he gets back on the hill, it looks pretty good, because we didn't even talk about Matt Strom, who gives you some good innings in relief last year. It's a pretty good bullpen. But to close it out here, I'm wondering where you are with Connor Brogdon, who's sort of sneaky doing. I mean, he's got a 2.35 ERA. The whip's a little high, so he's struggling, obviously, with command and control. But I mean, Frank and I have been kind of wondering, is this going to be it? Is he going to be the Connor Brogdon from like 3 years ago who showed you something? Or is he going to be, I guess, post-COVID Connor Brogdon, who just never gets it back?
Ah, man, I am the wrong person to ask because I'm such a Connor Brogdon apologist. Connor Brogdon. So my favorite two pitchers growing up, I'm not counting like Halliday or Lee or Hamels. I'm talking about just kind of like under the radar guys until they became over the radar. My two favorite pitchers growing up were Ryan Madsen and Gavin Floyd. I loved Gavin Floyd's stuff. We traded him for Freddie Garcia. I was a heartbroken teenager. But Ryan Madsen had that big, nasty, nasty over the top delivery with that disgusting changeup. Connor Brogdon's changeup from the right side is the closest thing out of the Phillies bullpen that I remember to Ryan Madsen's. And so like, I've always kind of clung to that as like, he's got it. He needs to work on his control, harness it. And he could be an effective sixth to seventh inning weapon. I maybe once said he was our future closer to my friend Ryan. I may have been wrong about that, but I do think he has a future in the bullpen. However, if I'm the Phillies, I'm potentially looking at him as a stretched out kind of long man. Like, I would like to see Connor Brogdon be your three inning, come in the fifth type of guy. He got some huge outs in the World Series in 2022. He was lights out in the 2022 postseason, and then again kind of fell off the map last year. We still roster Dylan Covey, and I still don't know why. If you could have Matt Strom take that role, I know Spencer Turnbull probably going to take that role, at least to begin the year. I would like to see Connor Brogdon kind of take over that fifth inning, not so much mop up, but like if Taiwan's not giving it to you or Sanchez can only go five, that's where I'd like to see him. I think he's got a place on the roster. He's got plenty of time. He's got plenty of options. I just don't know if he's going to get an opportunity without injury this year. Simple as that. I think it's going to take a couple of injuries to get him back.
Yeah, no doubt. And don't feel so bad, because it wasn't too long ago that I felt Connor Brogdon was going to be an awesome setup man to closer Sir Anthony Dominguez. So, I mean, I think we, we that's what we do. We get excited about young arms and then they tantalize us. And then as we see in the majors every year, like middle relief is so year to year. Like, you could literally hate this guy next year and then love him again the year after. It's just middle relief, the nature of being a middle reliever.
Real Cormier, Jeff Geary, anyone?
Jeff Geary, the GEO, Jeff, always a favorite of mine.
Yeah.
How about Junior Marte having a nice spring? Again, he's another guy. It's like when he gets out there, you talked about the Ramon Rosso, right? It tantalizes you in the spring. Then you get out there and it's like, man, you got great stuff, but you just don't know where it's going all the time.
Nasty, nasty. He even picked up a save last year against the Athletics on, I think it was even on Father's Day, or right around there. And it's just nasty, nasty stuff again. I think back to his like first outing as a Philly last year. I think it was against the Yankees. He came in a tough situation and blew up right away. And then it kind of snowballed for a little bit. He got it back in June-ish. And then it fell off the map. And that is just the nature of the relief pitcher. It takes a while to be established. I think Topper is much like Charlie Manuel in the sense that, like, if a guy fails once, that's not it for him. He'll give him a couple more opportunities, like Andrew Bellotti, Nick Nelson. Like they had a pretty decent rope. Even like a Kirkering, which I actually think maybe was more on Topper than Kirkering. You put Kirkering in a 10-0 game two for no reason whatsoever. They saw him. They got a book on him. Then you pitch him again in game three. And it's like they teed off. They saw the slider. They knew it was coming. So like I think there's like a little bit to like strategic when you need to use him. But again, it falls on the arm itself for trying to stay within yourself. Don't overthrow. That's been Marte's problem because he'll overthrow. He'll get nasty. It'll miss by 3 feet, and then he has to throw one right down the middle, and it gets smoked. So Marte, nasty stuff. And again, a good problem to have. The Phillies have done an amazing job of just stacking their pitching depth with guys with stuff. And they've done a good job figuring that out. We got more out of Bellotti than we ever should. Same with Hoffman. You can kind of go down the list there. So I trust Mattingly. I trust Cotham. I trust Barber. I trust all of the folks that are bringing these arms along, developing them. And it's nice to know that, like, if there are a ton of injuries, at least we're not throwing Tyler Cloyd out there. It's dudes with stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And by the way, it's kind of funny because you mentioned like Dylan Covey still being on the road. I mean, you also slid a Nick Nelson reference in there, and it's like the same thing. It's like, man, Nick Nelson still, because he is sort of that reminder of that bridge from what they used to be to what they've now become by stacking arms. To your point on the injury, and maybe as we talked about this flu situation with Kirkering, if he's not ready for opening day, and it pretty much looking like he might not be, we'll see. But if he's not, that could open up the door for Brogdon to be on the team, to come up north and maybe to sort of kind of carry over here what he has done in spring. But otherwise, Pickens are slim. I mean, they've got their guys, and anybody else is just sort of fighting to make this, you know, they brought in Colby Allard. He's had an okay spring, and we'll have to just see where they want to go with those last few spots.
Michael Mercado, too, is another interesting arm. They sent him down recently, but he's on the 40-man still. He's got nasty, nasty stuff. They picked him up off, I believe, the Rays. And anytime you get any player from the Rays, he could have one arm, and he'll still just be nasty out of the pen. They just find a way to be a pitching factory. So think about it. You know, we got Christopher Sanchez from the Rays. We got Jose Alvarado from the Rays. We actually won a trade. With the Rays, which just never happens. We give up Garrett Clevenger for Jose Alvarado. So I think that Mercado's got stuff. He throws 96, but again, young, developing, but you add him to that stable of Marte, of Brogdon, and we'll see if they get a chance. Again, it's a really good bullpen. Even with Covey as the long man, it is a really good bullpen. And it's nice to know that you get to that sixth, seventh, you're not biting your nail so much. It's all right. Let's just do our job and we'll go win 91 games.
Love it. All right. Let's transition here to the offense. And again, just a ready-made World Series contender offense, something we've talked about since the end of last year. However, all the good vibes about Johan Rojas when he came up and hit the ball well and play superb defense. Of course, he got exposed in the playoffs. I don't think anybody's surprised by that, but the glove is always there. Well, he had a chance. He was given a chance this spring, and Dave Dombrowski was pretty honest about this in every interview that he's done, whether it's WIP or anywhere else, saying, hey, you know, he's not guaranteed to come north. He's going to have to make us want to take him up north, but you always felt like he would at least get an opportunity. 15 games, 48 at-bats, batting .167 on base percentage. Hold on to your hat here, Greg. Of .184. He has struck out 8 times, which isn't terrible. I mean, he's obviously just, you know, rolling over and grounding out.
He's swinging.
Yeah, he's swinging. He's swinging. He is swinging, he is not producing offensively. What do you see in his future? Immediate future.
Finally able to drink a beer. I mean, the kid is just so young. He's got options. He doesn't seem super flappable. He doesn't seem like if you were to make the move to, let's say, Pache as your everyday center fielder, which, hot take, that's how I would go if I were Topper. I'm not, but if I were, that's where I would go. he can still collect himself in AAA, work on the swing down there. He did change his swing in the offseason. On top of bulking up, on top of trying to lose the hole in his swing, he did completely change it. That stuff takes time, especially against live pitching. I expected him to come out and walk one time and swing a ton because he's working on the swing. If you're working on a swing, you're not going to stand there and take pitches. You're going to swing the bat. And so, you know, again, it's for me, I'm looking at the contact. Is he barreling up the baseball? Is he making hard contact? Is he hitting it gap to gap? Is he trying to be Willie Mays Hayes? And I'm still unfortunately seeing a lot of soft contact. When he does try to bunt, is that working out? Because we know that he could be a weapon if he just learned how to lay down a bunt. So, yeah, unfortunately, I'm still not seeing the hard contact, the barrels. He had a nice RBI single earlier today in a game against the Rays. But, yeah, my opening day center fielder is Christian Pache, and I'm not even thinking twice about it. I'm moving Rojas to AAA. I'm letting him get his swing down. I'm letting him get some confidence. He had the weirdest 302 average I've ever seen last year. Clearly was a phantom thing, but if he can hit 240, I'm okay with that. Yep. I'm because the glove more than makes up for the 240. But to me, Pache gives you two things that Rojas doesn't: a little bit of pop and not that much of a downgrade on defense. And that's saying a lot because Rojas is an automatic Gold Glove contender. Pache's really, really good too. You're not losing too much, and you get to keep Marshy in left, which I think is a weapon personally. And so, yeah, I am actually going to go with Pache as my opening day center fielder. Let Rojas get his time in AAA. He is my center fielder still, at least, you know, for the second half, unless he just burns out in AAA. But yeah, I still think the job will eventually go to Rojas. I'm just starting with Pache.
Yeah, and it sounds like, and I think I agree with you here, this is just about confidence for Rojas that you don't want to destroy, because you're really, in a sense, if you send him to AAA or keep him at AAA and go up with Pache, you're just trading one light-hitting outfielder who plays great defense for another. So, like you said, there's not much drop-off, but somebody can make the argument, well, if that's the case, why don't you just keep Rojas in center then, if you're not going to get much offensive production, but you still want to have him at the major league level? But I agree that I think at this point, you want him to get at bats at AAA. You want him to be there, getting his confidence up, see if you can get rolling. And it could be just a couple of weeks before you bring him back up. I mean, if Pache can even stay healthy for a couple of weeks, the way his career has gone. So
that's the one, right? So Pache is an injury waiting to happen. So that's definitely opening the door for Rojas. Number two, Rojas has options. Pache does not. He does not have any minor league options left. The guy was like a top 15 prospect in baseball. He has the pedigree that you'd want to. I would not want to risk him to waivers. There is a 0% chance he goes unclaimed, unlike maybe Jake Cave, who I know is a left-handed hitter, but that's my out guy, right? If Rojas is tearing it up and Pache is somehow still healthy and I'm ready to put, you know, give Rojas that chance in center again, I'm getting rid of Jake Cave. I'll bring up Rojas, keep Pache on the roster. I'll sacrifice the left-handed bench bat. I know you got Merrifield's right-handed, and it would make you very, very right-handed. But that's not something for my bench with the DH that I'm necessarily super worried about. Right. That stuff all has a way of playing itself out. Give me the defense. Give me the clubhouse. And no offense to Jake Cave, I couldn't care less if I see him ever again or not. He is a nothing guy for me. So that's just how I feel.
Yeah, every time I see him playing a game or scoring, and then he turns around and he's got like the whitest,
the white beard,
the silver platinum. I'm like, oh man, you know, they're like, it's like you're just one guy away from like, and there, you know, obviously it was supposed to be Merrifield. If that could have been the guy, if Pache and Rojas both made the team, you wouldn't have to worry about that. But that might be a conversation for a few weeks away. I do wonder, though, if there will be more looks, Greg, of Merrifield in left field and Marsh in center against certain pitchers, you know, especially because Pache doesn't hit really well and because Merrifield has been hitting well in spring and gives you versatility and, you know, maybe like the double leadoff guy if you bat him ninth. I wonder if he'll play a little bit more than we've seen the ordinary number four outfielder on the Phillies play.
You're paying him $8 million. And so like that tells me he's going to get 350, 400 at bats.
Yeah.
You know, they still have this weird thing about Marshy against lefties, even though Marshy is kind of not proven himself against lefties, but he's not an automatic out. Nope. But I would agree. I think, Yeah, Merrifield's a wonderful insurance policy, but I don't want to overexpose him in his mid-30s. He had a really tough injury last year after he made the All-Star team. He hit like 170 in the second half. So I'm looking to try and keep him at 3 days a week, maybe four. But yeah, 3 days a week I think would be my sweet spot there. And you have that. That's another luxury you have is Marshy. While he's not as good in center field as Rojas or Pache, he was brought here as our future center fielder. When we traded for him, when we traded Logan Ohapi for him, it was center fielder. And so for him to be, and by the way, he was a Gold Glove finalist in left that year. Even though he ended in the National League, he was an American League Gold Glove finalist for left field. That's how good he was up until August. He still stayed that. So I really do believe like he's best suited to play left. Merrifield, left, second base, whatever. Stott's a Gold Glove caliber second baseman to me, and hopefully my future leadoff hitter, but I digress. That's for another show.
That is.
Yeah. Merrifield, just a great weapon to have, great depth. And if they didn't do a lot this offseason, the one thing they did to get Merrifield, I have been a proponent of that signing since before they made it. I was in love with it. I don't think 8 million's overpaying. I'm really happy with the deal, and I think he's going to be a nice little X factor for you. My
Oh, I
question to
agree.
you, the only thing, this has nothing to do with Merrifield or anything. It's just another name to keep in mind, although he's a right-handed stick. Does Scott Kingery have a future anymore for this team?
I feel like this is the batting version of the discussion that we had about Connor Brogdon, right? Except at least
They're
Connor
not
Brogdon,
wrong.
I wouldn't feel, if Connor Brogdon is on the major league team, you're like, okay, he deserved it, he earned it, and you expect that maybe you'll recapture it. Whereas Kingery has year after year after year given opportunity to recapture it, and now it's, dude, I almost kept him on a fantasy baseball team 1 year in a keeper league. I almost made him a
Good
keeper,
for you.
Greg. Yeah,
Listen,
good for me for not, but
he's not a $6 million man anymore. He's on like a minor league deal. Well, he's on this, I guess, final year of arbitration or whatever. So he's not going to cost you what he did. It's just one of those things where I think I've just always had a soft spot. He had
agreed.
that really, really rough bout with COVID. It really took a toll on him, and he was not the same player. The Phillies, and I have to say, the Phillies screwed him up by throwing him all over the diamond. I think about like Nick Senzel from the Reds, who just got thrown everywhere. Now he's a National, and I just don't want to see Kingery just get see you later because of the things, obviously he has a part in it, but the way the Phillies kind of mishandled his positional, I guess, just his positions overall. So again, if there are three or four injuries to the bench, I wouldn't mind it. I don't think he's on the 40, but I wouldn't mind it if they dip their toe into the Kingery pool one more time to give
Sure.
the guy a fourth outfielder or utility shot.
And this would be the type of team where you feel like there's no pressure on him, where he could maybe play
Right.
in a position pressure free. Now, the mad scientist in me was like, he does have the ability to play the infield and the outfield, even though that wasn't the best recipe for him. And we just sat here and talked about, do we really want Jake Cave as the fifth outfielder? Could we kill two birds with one stone and have this guy, back on the fort or taking up a spot and being both your fifth outfielder and an infielder? But, you can
That's
also ask.
Merrifield, though.
No, right.
That's Merrifield, though.
Right.
Yeah,
Plus,
Merrifield is
also
the Kingery who can actually
you
do it.
have Clemens, who's, I'm not a Cody Clemens guy. I never have been, but I cannot deny that he's having a very nice spring, and he's probably making himself a pretty good case to make the team.
He's a left-handed stick, too. So there's another. Hey, listen, if you are looking to go left-handed, Jake Cave, it's funny because we would. For 2 years now, we've been sitting here saying, oh, a left-handed stick, bench bat, pop, Derek Hall. Not even in the conversation anymore. Just like it's a real shame because again, another a great guy, good clubhouse fit, gets you a homer off the bench. You want to talk about Matt Stairs? Like that's Derek Hall, swings for the fences. And yeah, just a shame. He had the thumb injury and just can't find it, can't really hit for average. And I wish him the best too. I hope he can find a way to make an impact to this team somehow eventually too, because he's just a good dude.
It is. He's having a rough, he's making Mario Mendoza look like Tony Gwynn this spring, which is
Yeah,
unfortunate
rough
because
spring.
you know the power's
Understatement.
there, right? Yeah, you know if you gave him a bunch of at bats in a row, but it ain't going to be with the Phillies, and it ain't going to be on this team. All right, we've had an awesome time. We're going to close it out with just one question. You're going to answer one question. Yes, sir. You don't even have to give context. You've already sort of foreshadowed it. but I'll ask you a two-part question. You just give me the answer. Two parts is this. Who would you like to see be the leadoff hitter? Who will be the leadoff hitter?
Are we talking opening day or by season's end?
Oh, you're making it a three-part question. So go for it. Go all three right there. Let's start with
all right.
Who do you want to be the leadoff hitter? I think you already mentioned.
Long term, I want Bryson Stott to be my leadoff hitter. Bryson Stott, Trey Turner, Bryce Harper just sounds so sweet.
I'm with you.
I just think it will be Kyle Schwarber.
It will be Kyle Schwarber. And by the end of the year, if you want to add a wrinkle there, do you still think it'll be Kyle?
It will still be Kyle Schwarber.
I would love to commission it'll a study still be Kyle Schwarber. And I don't know how you could do it, because eventually it all comes down to subjectivity. The whole record with Kyle Schwarber as the leadoff hitter and not, I mean, it's so overwhelmingly speaks to making him the leadoff hitter, but the freaking, I don't know, contrarian in me or the journalist in me always says, is there causation there? Is there definitive cause and effect? Or is it he's playing on a really good team that eventually figures it out and wins a lot of games while he's the leadoff hitter? Like, are they that good because he's the leadoff hitter? Or like, if you switch them to fourth and played the whole season out, would they have their same record anyway? Every time I try to bring up the argument, everybody just throws the record in my face. So I really can't. I have nothing other than cause and effect.
I will not throw the record in your face. I will just say this. Sometimes it is really nice to be up 1-0. Just like that. And he does offer that. And you're only the leadoff hitter once. I mean, let's just really call what is, especially in the lineup we have. Like you were saying, Merrifield in that 9 spot, if that's where he could end up, you know, if Pache doesn't work out or whatever, that's almost like having that 2 type of leadoff hitter, you know. So to me, as much as I love the idea of Stotty, you know, being up 1-0 2 pitches into a ball game ain't so bad either. So again, a good problem to have.
Right. I agree with you on everything you said. The one thing I think sometimes, though, is the impact on the lineup on down. And could things be different if, like, for example, they batted Bohm cleanup, right, throughout the playoffs last year.
And
you just wonder if batting, and I understand Rob Thompson wasn't going to do it, fine. But if changing where Schwarber is in the lineup has that trickle-down effect and that you don't have a guy like Alec Bohm in the World, or not the World Series, in the playoffs, though, struggling there, having to hit fourth, because that's the way the lefty-righty thing plays up. But, you know,
Can I give 2 sentences on that, though?
You may.
To your point, because I agree with it, I've said it before on X or Twitter, where nobody should ever follow or listen to me there. I speak into the void. If Kyle Schwarber batted in the middle of this order, he'd have 450 RBI. And the thing is, right, you put him in the 5-hole because the lefty righty thing, you're not going to go Harper, Schwarber, Topper will never do it. If you were to go Bohm in at four, Schwarber 5, that might benefit Bohm simply because teams might not want to face Kyle, maybe give Bohm some more fastballs, this, that, and the other. Bohm is an excellent fastball hitter. He puts the ball in play. So maybe that helps Bohm from the 4-hole. So, like, again, Stott, Turner, Harper, Bohm, Schwarber, JT, Casty, Marshy. Like, that's a heck of a lineup. You're adding a ton of depth to it, which, again, just makes the case that Stott should be the long-term answer at leadoff. Here's the thing, though. Schwarby only has 2 more years left. Stott will be the long-term leadoff hitter eventually anyway.
I agree with you on that. I look forward to that day. And, hey, maybe that's sometime this October. This red.
You never know.
October, Greg. You never know. Listen, you've done a great job filling in. Really appreciate it. Love the insight. Love the discussion. Looking forward to the opening day next week, as we all are. And why don't you just really, you know, take some time here to tell us about your other podcasting venture, which is We Podcast and Know Things, correct?
Yeah, We Podcast and We Know Things. We are coming up on 8 years. We've podcasted in 10 different years now, so that's crazy. Friends for 30 years doing it. Over 400 episodes, over like 50 interviews with bands and movie directors and video game developers and actors and all that good stuff. So we just released an episode today. It's we are a monthly show now. So, you know, if you're listening to this, you're looking for, you know, our thoughts on potentially the best show going right now in Shogun on FX and Hulu. What a great series. You can get our thoughts on that. We are a movies, TVs, video game, music pod. And so, yeah, if you're looking for that nerdy side, that pop culture side, we podcast and we know things. We've been around forever. We're not going anywhere. 400 episodes and we'll be there probably until I can't record a podcast anymore, quite frankly.
Awesome. Love to hear it. Love to see podcasts survive. And again, we podcast, we know things. Latest episode on the on Shogun. Shogun is the best show on television, according to Greg Hall, and we podcast and we know things. Where can they find you on X, formerly known as Twitter?
If you want to go down the rabbit hole with me, that's at Greg Talks A Lot. So at Greg Talks A Lot on X and Twitter.
Well, again, we love it when you talk a lot and when the subject is the Philadelphia Phillies. All right, Greg, thanks so much for joining us. That has been another episode of the Powder Blue Podcast. We'll catch you on the next one.